And here we go. Welcome. I am Matt. This is the Anarchist Investor Alive, coming at you every Monday through Friday at 12 Eastern on the Ungovernable channel. I am talking about contrarian investment, markets, the economy, crypto, all kinds of stuff. And actually, today we're going to talk a little bit more about real estate. I know. Oh, how boring. Ugh, real estate. That being said, the algo doesn't like me all that much, so I need your help. So whether you're on the live right now or you're listening to or watching the recorded version, do me a favor and throw me a sub, like, upvote, thumbs up, follow, share it, throw me a comment, and a reminder, because I'm here live, and I want you to join me live if you're listening to the recorded version, but because I'm here live, and those of you who are watching me live, you can throw a comment into the chat and we can talk about whatever you're looking at or, if you agree or don't agree on my assessments and what we're talking about, then I want to hear about that too, because friction is the way you get a fire started. And it's also a way that you can build a really good investment philosophy. So that being said, what are we looking at today? On the hold screen, I had the price of lumber. Oh my God, so boring. Why aren't we talking about Bitcoin? Look, there are certain pockets. I talked about this yesterday. There are certain pockets of the economy where inflation is alive and well, and it has been for a long time. And those pockets of the economy typically also are dominated by economic forces. And so all of the interventions that happen within those spaces are just kind of like, you know, either making the problem worse or taking the edge off a little bit. And they're just doing it at the margins. It's not, the politicians and the regulators and, you know, the Jamie Dimons of the world, they're not in control. Okay. They are, however, potentially helping or hurting the curve. Housing is one of those areas. Okay. And we're going to dive into this today because this is really, really important. I also wrote about this yesterday. In fact, I'm getting into the shameless self-promotion early in today's video. But if I pull up this article that I wrote yesterday morning about essentially culture and how that influences investments. I definitely wrote about how young people and their investment philosophy is directly affected by culture, their outlook, how they feel about the economy and the country or the place that they live and things like that, and what kind of faith they have in those, you know, institutions. And a lot of times the young have faith in different institutions than older Americans do or did, and that's influencing decision making. Well, part of the investment decision making and part of the influence on the investment decision making that's happening right now has to do with housing, because a lot of millennials and zoomers are essentially finding it extremely cost prohibitive to buy housing. Now, there's something very important we have to talk about housing, because a lot of people think that mortgage rates are really what determines, kind of the supply and demand mechanics within the housing market. And that really isn't the case. You have to remember that just interest rates in general are all relative. I mean, there are situations where, you know, a 20% interest rate actually makes sense, right? From a business standpoint, if you can borrow money at 20%, but you know your return on capital is 25, 30, 40%, it can make sense to borrow at 20%, right? There's also times when borrowing at 1% doesn't make sense, okay, relative to, you know, what the potential down the road income or investment return is based off of that borrowed money. And then the vice versa, right? Like it's all relative to what the environment is that's happening. And within housing, one of the probably the biggest component will and always will be the price. It's always going to be the price, because in certain markets, you know, the price of a house could be extremely low and the mortgage rate could be extremely high, and it makes sense to buy, at a high mortgage rate. And in other markets, the pricing of that house could be high and it could be at a low mortgage rate. And it doesn't make any sense to buy because the house is overvalued. Like, the interest is just a way of kind of calculating the time cost of money. Okay. And I don't want to get too nerdy because I'm going to put you to sleep at lunchtime here. But it's just a way of calculating the time cost of money, right? Like, you know, if I borrow this money today, what does it cost every month or year in order to have it today versus if I borrowed it 10 years ago or if I borrow it in 10 years, right? That's just a way of calculating that. That has nothing to do with whether or not an investment, or it doesn't have nothing to do with it. It has to do with what your monthly payment is. But whether you can afford the monthly payment or not is a separate conversation as to whether or not that's a good investment. Okay, if that makes sense. Like, there's a lot of things that are good investments out there that, like, I can't afford, you can't afford. Doesn't mean that they're not good investments. Just means you can't invest in them because the upfront cost. Like, you and I can't build a nuclear power plant by ourselves, right? But that doesn't mean that it's a bad investment. You know, you would have to pool money and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Which, by the way, I wrote about uranium this morning too, which is super fun. If you're not like a free subscriber on the newsletter, definitely do it. I write about some traditional stuff, you know, investing and certain kind of buying and selling behaviors and stuff like that, and the prognosis for certain types of investments in the marketplace. But then there's also some harebrained stuff that I talk about. This morning I wrote about uranium, and actually I think uranium, if you've watched the live cast in the past, is a good long-term investment. So that's why I wrote about it. But I didn't really write about it in terms of, like, you know, what the current price is or whatever. I just kind of dove a little bit into what uranium is, what nuclear power is and whatnot. And the beauty of it is if you subscribe for free, April 1st, less than a week away, live on this program, I will be giving away free actual money. This is silver, 4 ounces of silver. I will be giving this away on the live cast. I feel like I'm doing sleight of hand here by, like, showing, like, the coins in front of the camera. Not that I can do that. But that being said, back to housing. So having looked at kind of that dynamic and talked about mortgage rates versus prices, prices are elevated. They've been elevated for a long period of time. In fact, there's so many, like, I was looking for memes and stuff to throw onto some future articles as well as onto the broadcast today. And there's so many memes about, you know, what a house used to cost in 1960 and 1970. Interestingly enough, in 1970, 1980, 1990, when you were buying a house, I mean, your mortgage rates were double digits, right? Nowadays, you know, you could still get a 7% mortgage, 6% mortgage, even if you have crappy credit for the most part. And that just goes to show you how, you know, that kind of relative evaluation works. And it was actually a good investment. If you bought back in the 80s and your mortgage rate was, you know, 10, 15, 20% in some cases. But so that being said, there's a constancy in the real estate, specifically the residential real estate marketplace. And that constancy is a deficit in the supply of housing. Okay. So this exists for a multitude of reasons, one of which is that building housing is a capital intensive upfront, you know, kind of cost thing. Two is that there's a lot of regulation and zoning and kind of like red tape that gets in the way. And the third of which is that housing is slow. Like, you can't just build a house today and it goes on the market tomorrow, right? Like, if you crank up the widget factory tomorrow, you have widgets going out the door and being shipped out to your end user or purchaser. Housing doesn't work that way. You have to plan, you know, years in advance in terms of putting these things in certain places where the housing demand is going to be high, meaning the surplus is at a deficit. And you're also going to have to navigate the price of commodities that are associated with housing, right? So the biggest input costs are going to be labor, and it's also going to be the actual stuff that you're building the house out of, namely lumber, copper, aluminum, you know, like there's a handful, like concrete, right? Like, there's a handful of costs there. And if those commodity costs are not working for you, you're not going to build the house. Right. And again, just like with interest rates and mortgage rates, there's times when home builders, you know, take baths on houses. In fact, if I pull the chart back up, you'll actually see that in 2020 and 2021, there were a number of home builders that had started projects that just took baths on the projects that they had started because the price of things like, well, I don't have the price of lumber that goes back this far. Let me see if the futures contract on copper goes back this far. Yeah. So if you go back and you look at the price of copper back, 2020 into 2021, say you started a housing project, and this is messy because it's just a daily chart, but say you started a housing project like, you know, sometime in the end of 2019, beginning of 2020, you have, you know, a couple dozen units that you're trying to finish. All of a sudden, lockdowns happen, supply shortages happen. You have to wire the house, right? You can't sell a house without electricity. It's against zoning laws, right? It's against a building code, right? So what happens? You have to go out and you have to buy electrical wire that, you know, copper is a major component in. Well, the price of copper went from basically like $240 and peaked out, you know, over double that. So your wire cost doubled depending on when you were purchasing it, you know, during that time frame. Not to mention the fact that the nature of home building is also that if you do know you're going to need a lot of wire, you can purchase it like a little bit in advance, but you can't purchase like a huge amount and warehouse it. Like it becomes expensive. Even the largest home builders, you know, they warehouse a little bit of this stuff, but ultimately what they have to do is place the order ahead of time. And in many cases, it's being delivered to the job site, you know, on an on-demand kind of basis. It's not, you know, something that's just, there's not just acres and acres and acres of, you know, electrical wire sitting waiting for, you know, one or a handful of projects, right? There's an immediacy sometimes that's needed in order to complete these projects, right? And so you can't really, you can't hedge that great. If you do, you know, home builders, just to give you like an inside look at them as well, you know, home builders from like a cash perspective, they don't have ridiculous amounts of cash to also like say like, you know, buy puts or calls on some of these input costs and hedge. They do a little bit of that, but they don't have like a huge stockpile of cash all that often that allows them to hedge out into the future the cost of these things. So their profitability is literally tied to, you know, these commodities. Okay. So why am I talking about this? Well, this is essentially an area of the market where inflation is continuing to be there, right? And, you know, some of those other memes that I was looking at, I've actually shared some of them in the past. It's like, you know, oh, like, you know, the value of my house is going up. And, you know, the other person giving them the bad news is like, well, that's because the value of your currency is going down, right? Or the currency buying it is going down. There's a little bit of that, but there's actually a huge component of this supply demand, imbalance that's happening. And it's been consistent for a long period of time. It's just the nature of housing, because also in the past when, whether it's the government or even private businesses have tried to kind of like buck that trend, a lot of times they end up eating huge losses and, you know, companies go out of business because if you overbuild too quickly, you know, housing is a very regional economy or marketplace, right? And so, you know, it's region dependent, right? So like here in New Jersey, you know, the average home price, I think, is like, you know, plus 300 or plus 400,000. I mean, there's areas in Detroit and Michigan where the average home price is like 30 grand, 40 grand. Right? It's very much a regional marketplace, but these commodities aren't priced regionally. They're priced globally. Okay. Which also is another impact that has another impact in terms of where housing development happens and, you know, how profitable it is and even what types of housing you can build in those areas, which further adds to the difficulties of trying to match up and marry demand, you know, supply and demand. So the other thing I wanted to look at, and so, you know, we were looking at lumber before, we're looking at copper right now. We were looking at lumber before. Lumber is, it went up with the supply disruption from, you know, COVID in 2020. It came back down. So it was like in nosebleed territory. This chart only goes back to like 2022. In, you know, 2021, I think we were pushing like 1,000. I forget what the amount here is, it's not per ton, it's per some other measurement, but I mean, it was basically $1,000 per unit. 2022 shows you it had already dropped down to like, you know, 700 per unit. And then the lows that we hit basically in 2023 were somewhere around, you know, 450 per unit. Now we're back up at 600, right? So we've popped back up. And even if you just look a year earlier, I think a year earlier, we were at about 500, if I remember that correctly. Yeah, like in March, we were like in the 5 to 550 range, which means the cost of lumber for anyone using it as an input cost has gone up by 50%. Sorry, 20%. Mathiness. Has gone up by 20%. In a best case scenario, it's gone up by 10%, depending on where you're taking that look back from, right? So it's gotten more expensive. Same thing with copper, same thing with, you know, actually I haven't looked at aluminum in a while, but I think aluminum probably has a similar dynamic here. Actually, aluminum hasn't run up that much yet, but also aluminum isn't nearly as important in building a home as wood and copper for wiring, obviously. So that being said, and you know what? I completely forgot. There's also other dynamics here that are at play. So you know how I mentioned, you know, kind of like the federal government and investment groups like meddling in the market and not being able to fight the economics? Well, here, let me pull this up for you. This is something that's happening in my beautiful neighbor across the water here in New York City. They have a home first down payment assistance program. Okay. So now, before I even read this, remember what I was saying. We have a supply problem. We don't have a demand problem. The demand for housing is consistent, right? In fact, because of the dynamics with mortgage rates recently, you know, some people have held off buying a house. And then you see what happens when someone puts a house up on the market. The demand fervor reawakens because it's still there. It doesn't go anywhere. Like, you might not be able to buy a house right now, but you still want one, right? Like, if you're starting a family or you're trying to move out on your own, whatever, right? Like, you want the independence. There's a demand that's still there, and it hasn't abated, like, for a long period of time. Even during the great financial crisis, it took a little bit of a break, but it's not like it went away. There were still people who wanted to buy homes. They just couldn't get loans, right? Or they were in the process of, you know, trying to sort out what homes were still livable after they sat vacant for like 18 months, 2 years, and, you know, people weren't making payments or there were squatters, you know, things like that. So that being said, we don't have a demand problem. And yet in many locales where real estate prices are like ridiculous, right? Like absolutely insane. New York City real estate prices are absolutely insane. And not only do you have this supply shortage, which is a portion of it being an actual economic force, you have all these other things like bureaucracy and stuff that gets in the way. And one of the things is they offer down payment assistance. Sounds like a great idea. Like, you know, let's help, you know, people who are poorer get into homes, which, by the way, you know, I'm not even going to dig into the default rate on some of these mortgages. But, you know, are you really helping them? Like, that's a conversation for another day. But They basically give up to $100,000 for the down payment on a home. Now, if I understood correctly, this isn't necessarily a grant. There are some grant programs, but there's also these down payment assistance programs that almost kind of work like, they work like mortgage insurance, where like they'll help pay your mortgage insurance up front, but then it gets rolled into the loan, right? So, I mean, they're basically just giving you the opportunity to buy something without having have saved up the money on the front end, right? So that being said, you know, programs like this, whether it be a grant or whether it be a loan, are putting people in homes and creating additional demand, or at least enabling people to buy homes that wouldn't have been able to, which, you know, spurs on demand and drives up prices, which ultimately is the determinant of whether or not, you know, housing is going to be affordable or not affordable. Okay. The other dynamic that we have here is that commodities are an area of speculation when it comes to investment firms. So, like I said about banks and things like that, you know, a lot of these investment firms, and I'm sharing an article from Reuters, it says basically funds stampede into copper as price breaks higher. Okay. And so this is based out of London. But again, remember, I mean, commodities are a global market. You know, a lot of these London based hedge funds are pushing into copper because copper had a 1 year kind of consolidation and it's breaking through the top end of that range. And as a result of that, you know, that investment speculation activity in further increased the cost of copper. So what's the take home? The take home is that as much as, you know, the Federal Reserve and the White House and everyone in government wants to like beat their chest and be like, oh, we beat inflation, right? Or we're beating inflation. Yes and no. Like there are areas where you're having success and there are other areas where you aren't, because you're not, you know, you don't understand, or you do understand and you're willfully ignorant about it because there's other things to be gained there, right? And so inflation isn't necessarily going away in certain areas. And in some cases, it's getting worse. Now, that being said, part of the reason why these commodities are going up in price is because home builders are beginning to build again, which is good, right? The more supply that comes on, the closer we get to narrowing that gap. We narrow that gap between supply and demand. That's a good thing. And that means that home inflation in the future could potentially be less, right? The issues with that are typically it's not like a consistent thing over a long period of time. You end up with this, you know, rise in housing starts, and then it falls off, and then you have another rise, and then it falls off. And so I've written articles about this in the past. I think real estate has been and will continue to be a very good investment over the long haul. And it's not as sexy as Bitcoin or even gold and silver, believe it or not. I mean, it's not as sexy as those things because it's just, you know, homes or being a landlord or you know, buying an apartment, a piece of apartment complex as like, you know, one of the investors in it or whatever. It doesn't seem that like, you know, glitzy and glamorous. But at the end of the day, it's also something that has a very long track record, and you have economics in your favor. And what I like about it is that typically when outside forces intervene into that economic space, it actually makes it more profitable to be in that space than less profitable. Now, yeah, there's all kinds of stuff that you have to deal with in terms of like, you know, squatters' rights and navigate all of that stuff. There's ways to get around that. So, for instance, I'm an advocate and an investor monthly on a small basis because I haven't bought any standalone properties yet in a company called Ground Floor. And Ground Floor allows you to, you know, purchase in small amounts stakes in real estate, and it allows you to earn a yield off of that money that you put there. And that is specifically, you know, valued based off of the real estate market and not, you know, the mechanics of the stock market directly or anything like that. And so it gives me the opportunity to have exposure to the real estate market, and specifically residential real estate market. The commercial real estate market is a different animal entirely. Everyone, I think, has heard stories about, you know, what's going to become of the commercial real estate marketplace. There's huge write-downs. There's going to be huge loan losses. And, you know, I've talked ad nauseum in the past about this. The banks have been pre-capitalized to try and deal with this, whether or not that actually works out as intended by the Federal Reserve and these banks, that remains to be seen. But, you know, you're going to continue to see tumult within the commercial real estate market, which, by the way, if you're, you know, a big time investor, or if you have a pool of big time investors and you know what you're doing, I mean, that does mean there's some opportunity there, right? There's some opportunity to pick up some fire sale type properties that might be in areas where, yeah, they're getting written down by 40, 50, 60% today, but longer term, once that, you know, reallocation happens, or once that revaluation happens, it could be a really, really good investment over the long term. So there is opportunity in that area. I'm just not sophisticated enough to talk about it. So you might have to go to someone else's channel, you know, go hit up Robert Kiyosaki to look into that kind of stuff, I guess. And I forget Robert has like his like lieutenant at arms who now has his own channel. I forget the guy's name. But they talk endlessly about that kind of stuff. So that being said, I think real estate inflation is going to continue, you know, despite the Fed's best efforts to curtail, you know, quote unquote, inflation as a whole, right? And it's going to continue to make inflation look higher in the aggregate, right? So that's going to complicate the market's expectation that they're going to get these like kind of like, you know, easy money, happy-go-lucky times into the future. So you need to keep an eye on this because I think we're going to have a couple of years where residential real estate prices, I'm not going to call them, I'm not going to say that they're going to collapse or fall. I would say they need to reset a little bit. They got like a little far too fast. And again, it's regional. So, you know, Florida and Texas and, you know, Tennessee, some of these areas where people flocked to during the COVID pandemic, I think are going to see a reset. The prices are going to come down. I don't think they're going to crater, but I definitely think they're going to come down to earth. You're going to see other areas where the prices hold up. And in fact, interestingly enough, you know, New Jersey saw net inflows from, you know, the COVID pandemic. And, you know, my home state has seen property prices hold up. And the reason being is because a lot of the inflows were from, you know, New York City transplants. And they're finding that they kind of want to stay in suburbia, but, you know, commute into work. And so there's going to be areas that hold up despite the fact that other areas are resetting in terms of price. And this is despite the fact that I think interest rates and mortgage rates are going to stay, you know, relatively high because people got used to like 4% and 5% mortgages. Now, how does this affect younger generations and investment? Well, unfortunate to say, I think younger generations, you know, based off the article I wrote yesterday, their mentality really needs to shift because they want to continue having certain kinds of luxuries and you know, entertainment. They want to continue buying the experiential things and going on vacation and all this other stuff. When you talk to someone, I mean, like I was talking to my grandmother over the weekend, when you talk to someone who bought their home back in the, you know, 50s and 60s, the house was the single biggest investment that you were going to make. And it was something that you cut every single corner in order to be able to purchase that house because it was more than just an investment. It was autonomy, right? Like it was a place to live that was yours. And we could talk politically about whether or not having to pay property taxes mean that it's actually yours or not. But it was yours. It was home base, right? Like it was kind of the basis for which a lot of the, you know, silent generation and the baby boomers built their nest eggs off of, right? Like that was the foundation of it. And a lot of faith was lost in that portion of the market after the great financial crisis, understandably so. But that being said, it doesn't mean real estate's a bad investment, right? It doesn't mean that as a, say like a mid-20s adult right now, that real estate is a bad purchase. A lot of folks in their mid-20s will say, well, it's not, you know, I can't afford it. Well, if you've cut to the bone all of your expenses and you still can't afford it, then yeah, you're probably correct. If you are someone who has, you know, a lot of this disposable income going towards like experiential stuff, or even if you're, you know, buying into Bitcoin thinking that it's going to go to the moon and that you'll be able to sell it and then buy some, you know, McMansion somewhere, I would caution you. I would say that you gotta, like, what's the M&M line? It's do you ever think that you gotta stop living up here and start living down here, right? Like, it's good to have dreams and goals, but those dreams and goals need to be grounded in some kind of like approach, right? Like there has to be a way of getting there. You could dream anything. Like, you know, I wish I'd sprout wings and I could fly tomorrow, right? If I don't have like a goal to getting there, and no, I'm not going to undergo, you know, genetic augmentation, but you know, if you don't have a goal to get to that, or you don't have a path, you know, that you can kind of see in front of you to get there, then it's kind of almost like a negative to have that goal or that dream, so to speak, right? There's a practicality that I think is missing in the investment acumen of the average person nowadays. And that practicality is that, you know, sometimes you just got to get back to basics, right? Like you just got to kind of get back to the boring, you know, not sexy, not like, you know, plus 20% a year kind of return type of stuff in order, one, to protect yourself over the long run, and two, to risk manage yourself. And you know, if you still have a little bit of money left over, by all means, take some of those, what I would call, you know, asymmetric bets on things where you're risking a little bit of money and you can make a whole ridiculous amount of money. But the bulk of what you're doing in your investment life should be focused on something that's more practical and more conservative. And I know it's really hard to do that because it's not like, you know, like fun, woo, like, you know, it's not a party, right? Like people don't get together and have like, you know, well, I mean, some people get together and have like a housewarming party and stuff, but you know, as far as I understand, you know, the real estate conventions are not like places where people are just like, it's not popping off there, right? Like there's some drinks and like drunk people around, but it's not like, there's not a rave going 24/7, right? At the Bitcoin conventions and the anarchist conventions and all this other stuff, there's definitely like this kind of air of a party going on. And it's tough to shun that, but that has to be done if you really kind of want to set the table for future success, at least in my opinion, right? I could be completely wrong. And like I said, if you're watching live or even if you're watching and listening to a recorded version, you know, let me know in the comments, like, am I off base here? Should we just be YOLOing into, you know, some of these sexier investments like Bitcoin, or should we actually be battening down the hatches, paying off debt and making sure that we only have good debt? And building things into our portfolio like real estate. All right, before I go, I want to walk through the rest of the marketplace, not just talking about commodities and housing today. So really quickly, I'm going to pull up Bitcoin and the crypto markets. Bitcoin today is, yesterday we had a pop. So yesterday's live was asking whether or not the Bitcoin bull was back. We did have a pop. So we're back up above the top end of that, you know, $69,000 range, and we're sitting at just about $69,900 and change right now in Bitcoin. And remember what I said yesterday, once we popped through that range, we had to come back and retest, right? There was one attempted retest here, but I wouldn't consider that a retest. Within the last 3 hours, we've had a much closer retest. And if you notice, there's this big tail that came down to kind of retest closer to 69,000 and the top end of that range. It is holding above. So again, we don't want to make impulsive moves here. It's pulled back to the top end of this range. I would say that, you know, if you're close to the time during the whatever week or month that you're normally dollar cost averaging into Bitcoin, this is a good time to pick up your monthly dollar cost average. If you're automated in terms of that, then don't worry about it. Just stick with it and see what's going. I mean, you know, doesn't look like collapse is imminent. It doesn't also, you know, seem like it's a to the moon kind of moment within the next couple of hours at least, or maybe even days. I would anticipate Bitcoin's going to continue to test the upper end of this range for at least a little while before we determine whether we fall back into the range or it's now back to all, you know, new all-time highs. Solana and everything else, because Bitcoin is down slightly right now, a lot of the other crypto coins and tokens that I follow are also pulling back slightly. So Solana's down, Avalanche is down, Polygon's down, CRO is down. So all of these things are kind of like pulling back. Some of them are pulling back to averages. Some of them are pulling back to significant price levels. It's super interesting to see algorithmically how this stuff just kind of mirrors each other. And I talked about this yesterday too, in terms of the commodification of crypto. There will be a day where there's like some dramatic differences in terms of how these coins perform. But right now, a lot of them are linked to Bitcoin and continue to be. So that's just the nature of the crypto marketplace right now. The other ones that I'm looking at, I mean, like, you know, Hive is back to 42. If you remember, I talked about taking a profit at about 45, 46 on Hive back when it made this run up to roughly like 49, 50 cents. So I took a little bit of profit, locked it into the stablecoin that's on the Hive blockchain. We're now back down to 42. And we broke through this kind of longer term range. If I pull up the daily chart, we broke through the top end of this longer term range. failed, came back, we're back above it again. And we're also kind of fighting this, you know, trend line that's sitting over the top of Hive. So something to watch on Hive, because if it can hold the top end of this range and continue to break higher, I think there's a really good opportunity. And Hive is one of those things where I do not see a short term or I don't see it as a short term investment. And I don't think most of the people who are stakeholders in Hive see it as a short term investment either, just based off of how things, you know, kind of get locked in, and there's wait periods and all kinds of other stuff where you can't just pull your money out, and it helps support the price, but also it helps support development on the platform and on that, you know, base layer token that then creates those apps that are built off the top of it. So I think Hive continues just to show some good strength here. And reacts, you know, there's some sell-offs and things like that, and there's some speculation built into it. But kind of like Bitcoin, there is a very religious, you know, foundation of support within Hive that is helping it maintain itself as well as build for the future. So a bright future going on there. And then a lot of the Helium names are just down a little bit in terms of recorrecting and things like that. All right, let's look at the casino and then we'll wrap things up here. Fixed income, high yield bonds. We've come back. And again, yesterday spoke about it. Today I'll speak about it again. These things don't move like uber fast. We pop through this resistance line and we're pulling back to it to retest it, to see whether or not we're going to continue to move higher on the risk profile with high yield bonds, or whether or not the future looks a little bit more conservative in terms of the risk market. So continuing to watch that, not a huge move or anything like that today. So more on that in the future. I'm not really going to talk about treasuries. I mean, treasuries are kind of mixed right now. It just means that there's a little bit of indecision. I mean, the only thing to note would be that, you know, it seems like people are buying shorter term treasuries and selling a little bit of the longer term treasuries. And that just means that, the inversion between the 2-year and the 10-year is just tightening a little bit. And anyone who knows traditional Wall Street kind of tendencies, when you have an inversion between the 2-year and the 10-year, and then it inverts and then de-inverts, usually within a short period of time, either leading up to that de-inversion or right after it de-inverts, there's usually some chaos. Okay, so that's why I continue to watch that. But today, not a lot of tectonic shifts as far as that goes. The dollar is fairly mute in terms of its relative value versus the other toilet paper that's out there circulating from the other countries that have fiat currency. Volatility is down. Again, I said, you know, volatility can continue to go down. There have been much lower readings in the past. In fact, leading up to 2008, I think we had readings somewhere in the like 9 range on the VIX. Right now we're at 12, almost 13. It's still a low level, and it means that there's some complacency built into the market. So shit could hit the fan without people really kind of expecting it to here, but it's not necessarily a given just yet. Oil is fairly flat. You know, we already looked at some of the other commodities. Silver is actually continuing to pull back. And so again, I have a longer term frame of reference on silver. I think it's going to outperform gold here into the future, but right now it's weaker than gold, and gold is holding up a little bit better than silver is. But again, typically when these things rally, you know, silver has the ability to rally a lot faster and a lot higher than gold does. So when we do hit the point where the Federal Reserve is cutting interest rates for whatever reason, I would expect silver is going to make up the stagger very quickly. And then, you know, as a result of it, the gold to silver ratio is moving higher, meaning, you know, gold is getting more expensive relative to silver, which I expect that ratio to come down, meaning silver will outperform it. And then also, I talked about uranium and writing about it this morning. The URA ETF continues to just kind of like plot along here sideways above this longer term support level. Like I said, this is a dollar cost average for me, small bits. I'm making huge bets, or investments in the near term. It's just kind of picking up small pieces as things go. And, you know, today's a down day. So like I said, if you're a dollar cost average person and you're close to your weekly or your monthly buy on something and it's down, it's usually a good time to pick it up, you know, in your normal course of events, as opposed to, you know, having to pick it up a little bit higher if it seems to rebound the next day or the day after. So just something to keep in mind there. And that's really it. I mean, I can pull up some of these individual stocks. NVIDIA is just below that all-time high when it spiked. And like I told you, we're watching this relative strength. The AI bubble, and it is a bubble, okay, because these market caps have far outpaced the growth in revenues. This ultimate top, or at least the all-time high that we saw a couple of weeks ago at 975, give or take, hasn't been reached again yet. But the price action leading up to this has shown less relative strength for NVIDIA. So that being said, this rally could be what's considered, you know, a sucker's rally, or basically a bull trap where we're about to reverse course. So we'll have to continue to watch this. But like I said, the relative strength, this is the strength of this move back to the all-time high in NVIDIA is less strong than what happened when it reached that all-time high the first time. So that could still end up being the high, or it could end up being just kind of like the beginning of the end. NVIDIA puts in a new high, but then ultimately it reverses course because it just doesn't have the support to keep going. That is a big bubble to watch, even though I don't advocate that people take big positions in these things, or I don't advocate putting much money to work in the casino at all. That is something to watch because it can be pivotal. It can move the marketplace for the worse. If the AI bubble pops and all these semiconductor stocks that have basically been propping up the Wall Street part of the market, you know, if those all fall. The other thing to look at is Apple has been very weak recently, and there's bad news again today or yesterday about declining shipments and kind of demand in China for Apple iPhones, which is still the cash cow over at Apple. So something to watch. When these, you know, Mag 7 stocks start to roll over, like Tesla already did, Apple rolled over. I think we've seen some rollovers. Amazon continues to be strong, but, Microsoft continues to be strong. As these things kind of get picked off of the top of that kind of like, you know, Mag 7 group, you could see the traditional stock markets start to roll over and show some weakness, which would lead into that tantrum that I've been talking about that I'm expecting before the Federal Reserve finally gives in and gives the candy to the child pitching the fit. But so with that, I know today was long. I appreciate you. Appreciate you sticking with me. And I'll be back again tomorrow, obviously at noon Eastern. And look, a reminder, throw your questions and comments into the chat. I'll get back to you even after I sign off because I like to talk to you and I want to hear from you. So with that, have a very good afternoon. Love you. Peace.